Hey guys, it's Candace.
And it's Elena.
And you're listening to Cousins on Crime. Hello.
Hi.
I like your, you have a little, a fluff, a pelt in your hair.
My hair is getting longer, so I just throw it up and I don't care what it looks like.
Well.
And today's that kind of day.
It's a cute messy bun.
Oh, thank you.
I can never do a cute messy bun.
I feel like I can't, but hey, if you say so, I'll believe you.
Mine's always a hot messy bun.
No, you're always cute.
Hot mess express. Stop. I accidentally put makeup on today because
I noticed that.
I thought I was going somewhere later, but really I wasn't. So here I am.
So have you been more productive because you...
No.
Oh, well.
No, not at all.
They say like if you put makeup on, if you put yourself together, you are more productive because you feel better.
It wasn't like that.
Oh, okay.
So I was going to take the twins to a trial dance class.
Oh.
At 5. And we record at 5.
Yeah.
And Daniel's like, well, what I thought you were recording. I was like,
oops.
Oh, I am. So I just felt stupid.
Aww.
Because I put makeup on.
Well, I guess you really did it for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm sorry I didn't do it
for you.
I did.
All along.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, my mouth is still a little bit sore, but I'm going to try to get through this.
I can't believe you.
This is going to be a two-parter. A two-part episode.
Y'all, Candace has been holding this podcast together. Like, she's not going to let y'all have a break. And I'm like, I'm the one saying they can wait 1 week. And yeah. She's like, no, we're doing it.
Yeah. So every time we take a break, it's Lena's
fault,
me. Basically.
She's holding us together.
No,
and
it's not. It's just...
So now we have to sit here and talk with her mouth pain.
Well, I've had this guy swirling in my mind for weeks now.
So let's get it out.
Yeah, I'm ready to be done with this guy. Okay. So it's been a minute since I did a serial killer case. Like a literal minute, because we just covered Robert Eugene Brashears not too long ago.
Mm-hmm.
Stand by for a mini-sode coming up on that guy, because mm-hmm. there's another case.
Yes.
That's just been linked to him.
Yeah.
But for this murderer, I read a book called To Kill and Kill Again by John Costin.
Mm.
And it was really good. If you want all the dirty details, if you love to read and you are intrigued by this story, go read it. I mean, see if I care.
Yeah.
But... trigger warning, there's going to be talk about rape in this one. So Wayne Nance was born October 1955. Who cares about the day? And he grew up outside of Missoula, Montana. His dad, George, was a long-haul trucker, and his mom, Charlene, was a waitress. I think if I never got married and had kids, I would be a long-haul trucker. I just, the open road, like
yeah.
You get to sleep in the back.
Eat
and
bags of chips while you drive.
You get to eat fast food all the time. Like,
it.
You
I
own
mean,
the road.
It's not glamorous.
It's
but
not
it's...
glamorous, but I'm not glamorous. Can't you see me as a long haul trucker?
No.
Okay,
no.
Well, it was my plan B.
But I'll drive with, I'll ride along.
That would be fun.
Yeah.
Remember when Kayla used to ride with her dad sometimes?
Yeah.
That was cool. Anyway, so he, Wayne, was a decent student academically, but really kind of an a-hole to his fellow students. And sometimes all in the name of a laugh, like he would just take things too far.
Oh.
And I think people chalked it up to him being bored. He was left at home alone a lot because his parents were always working. He got in notable trouble a few times when he purposely broke a little girl's glasses on the bus.
Oh, man.
This little girl's parents actually happened to own the trailer park that he lived in.
Oh, uh-oh.
Exactly. So the dad comes over and he's like talking to Wayne's dad. And Wayne's dad is like, you know, kids will be kids.
Mm-hmm. No.
Why do they always do it? They always enable. And George would do this Wayne's whole life.
Oh, man.
Minimize his bad behavior and sweep things under the rug, whether it was serious or not.
Mm.
So shortly after this incident, Elmer, this little girl's dad, saw Wayne do something really, really concerning. He saw this from afar. He's like walking down the street. He sees Wayne on the other side of the street. And there was like this incinerator. I don't know the details about it. Okay. I don't know if it was like attached to a restaurant or if it was a part of a plant or, you know, whatever.
Okay.
But there was this little litter of kittens walking past it.
Oh no.
And Wayne opened the grate that was on the incinerator and they all went in.
No.
Yeah. And so he was like, that's not normal. That is not normal. Wayne had siblings, and his parents did work really hard to provide, which, as I said earlier, left the kids home alone, unattended, mm-hmm. mostly Wayne, because, you know, the house was crowded.
Yeah.
This kind of reminds me of Kenneth McDuff. You know how he had all those brothers and sisters and he would like get out of the house and just tomfoolery all over the place. If you haven't listened to that series that I covered a couple years ago, can you believe I covered that a couple years ago?
No.
Feels like just yesterday. Woof. Anyway, Wayne was a bit of a menace at home and at school, trying to get a rise out of people, but he took it too far and it led to fighting. In 1968, George Nance, Wayne's dad, robbed a store. He tied up and beat the assistant manager, and that sent him to jail. And really, he didn't have to do that because the guy was counting the money at the end of the night.
Oh.
And he'd already placed all the money into a black bag, and he handed it over to George.
What in the world?
He gave it to George. George could have just peaced out, but he didn't. He took him in the back, he tied him up, and he beat him.
What?
I don't know why. Though Wayne didn't have the best reputation as a kid, now Wayne was a teenager, and I think people took pity on him because his dad, you know, he's from a low-income household. His dad is now in jail. It's his mom supporting the family and all these kids. And I think they just looked at him like, oh, you know, he's just a product of his environment in a way. I think people gave him that excuse.
And I think we could all make that mistake.
Yeah. Yeah, we can. And I think it could be true in some cases.
Sure.
And it probably was true in his case. The book uses the word tolerate, and it really is the best fitting word that people tolerated his behavior because of his situation.
Mm-hmm.
His teachers and fellow classmates tolerated his peculiarities, the weird drawings and fanciful things that he would say, like he was Conan the Barbarian.
Oh my gosh.
But he was very bright. He took college prep classes in high school, which gave him credibility on campus as like a serious student that may not have been his label otherwise.
Sure. Okay.
And this is all great. If Wayne just would have kept this up.
Yeah. Stayed on the straight path.
If he would have just, you know, overcome his environment, his circumstances, then, I mean, we wouldn't be talking about him and all of his victims. Just before Easter 1974, Donna Pounds was riding with a friend through Hellgate Canyon. Bit of an ominous word for what was coming her way.
Oh, no.
When she arrived home, it was quiet. Her youngest daughter, Kathy, was at school. Her oldest daughter, Karen, was 20, and she was working that day. And her husband, Harvey, was still at work. Now, their son, Kenny, had recently returned back to Fort Bliss, Texas, where he was stationed in the military. Harvey Pounds was a deacon at Bethel Baptist Church, and some reports say that he was at church on this day, but the book describes him being downtown at the department store where he was a shoe salesman.
Oh, okay.
And actually, I've seen a couple other reports that he was at, you know, the shoe place.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, there's a reason why that matters.
Okay.
He was mostly preoccupied with church business when he didn't have a customer in front of him. And that kind of wore on some people. It kind of rubbed people the wrong way. Harvey was very rigid. He was a fundamentalist Christian, and he had a bit of an attitude when it came to seeing other people spend their money in ways that he didn't agree with.
Oh, no. Like, and he would insert his opinion.
Exactly. Yeah. So, like, his brother had beer in his fridge or something. And
okay.
His brother bought, like, another harmonica when he had, like, 50. And he just thought that that was unrighteous and, like, a sin. And Donna wasn't too far afield from that sentiment. She, like Harvey, had attended the Prairie Bible Institute in Calgary, Alberta. Now, at the age of 39 years old, she was a homemaker who also worked part-time at the Christian bookstore.
Hmm.
And she volunteered at a local hospital. Girl.
How'd she find the time?
I'm not volunteering at a hospital. Are you kidding me? She's got three kids. A part-time job.
Mm.
No. But anyways, good for you, Donna. God bless. The Pounds home was on the market, actually, because they were planning to move just south of Missoula to Bitterroot Valley. So things were quite tidy and sparse in the home. It was a nasty Thursday afternoon.
Mm.
It was snowy. And because it was mid-April, the snow had begun to turn to slush.
Oh, no.
Turning everything to mud.
Uh-huh.
With no one home, the house was still, and maybe Donna contemplated what she would do next as she made her way through the house. You know, if it was me, I'd be like, I'm going to take a nap. She was probably more productive than me, to be honest. But when she reached her master bedroom just after 1:30 p.m., she was violently attacked.
Oh my gosh.
It was Wayne. And he actually had been to the Pounds house many times.
What?
Because he was friends with Kenny, Donna's son.
Oh.
Wayne had already retrieved Harvey's .22 caliber Luger from the hidden cabinet in the bedroom, pointing it at Donna to terrify her into submission. Wayne tied Donna's wrists and ankles to the bedposts with white rope, and he began cutting her clothes off with a sharp knife. He ripped off her sanitary napkin and threw it on the floor.
Oh no.
Of the bedroom before raping her. After defiling this poor church-going lady who volunteers at a hospital and works at a Christian bookstore.
A beautiful
can
soul.
Can you imagine how she felt?
Oh my goodness.
Ugh. In her marital bed.
Oh.
He escorted her, still undressed, down to the basement and told her to get on the floor.
Mm.
He wasted no time in this instance executing her right there with 5 gunshots to the back of her head.
What? And why?
Right.
Why?
Hold on for this next part.
Oh, no.
He inserted the barrel of the gun.
No.
And left it into her vagina.
What?
Left it there.
I mean, if you didn't think he was sick already, now you know he's
heinous.
A sicko.
He's 18.
What?
He's 18 at the time of this crime.
Oh, that is so disturbing.
Now, Harvey Pounds arrived home 5:45 that evening. His 12-year-old daughter, Kathy, was watching TV in the living room with a friend.
When it happened?
No. So the crime happened at like 1:30 in the afternoon.
Oh, okay. So he arrives home.
he gets home and Kathy's there with a friend and they're watching TV.
No.
She had no idea her mother was down in the basement.
She never went to...
You know, they exchanged a casual hello and Kathy told her dad, hey, there's ropes on the bed.
Oh my gosh.
There's ropes on the bed and the rug is all bunched up. It looks weird. But she wasn't scared. She just thought it was a little bit weird and mentioned it and then went back to watching TV.
Oh my Lord.
Harvey was like, what? And Kathy was known to be a little jokester. So he's like, let me go look. So he goes to Kathy's bedroom. There's ropes on the bedposts. He goes to Karen's bedroom, the oldest daughter. Ropes.
Oh.
Out of the corner of his eye could see ropes in the bathroom as he walked past, around the toilet, hanging from the door. And then as he made his way to his bedroom, he saw the same white ropes that looked like clothesline tied to his bed. Mm. That's when he saw the bloody sanitary napkin on the floor. He saw Donna's clothes strewn about. Donna was a lady. Okay. Mm-hmm. This is not her style. And he knew that. So he just felt sick. Oh, All of it accumulated, sending a chill down his body before his eyes reached the corner of the room where he saw the empty holster of his gun.
Mm. Oh no.
He's like, I don't understand this. No. Nobody knows where that's hidden.
Oh.
But a few people. Now his blood ran ice cold and he darted to the living room. He said, Kathy, you know, you guys need to go to her house.
Oh.
And said, y'all need to go to her house, whoever this friend was, help them get their coats on and out the door. He even looked through the window to make sure that they had walked away from the house.
Oh, man.
The only place he hadn't checked was the basement. So he hurried down to the basement and found what can only be described as Satan's doing. And he called the sheriff's office. Now, swarms of officers arrived to Donna's home. When they saw what was inside, they too were horrified. I mean, murders didn't happen here. And this, I mean, something like this was absolutely evil.
Yeah, I'd say.
Whoever did this was a sexual maniac who clearly had no limits to the destruction that they would inflict. And this person, whoever they were, was out there somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
After driving around near the nearby streets, one of the deputies found a brown rubber glove with what looked like blood on it. It was on the side of the road, like streets away from the house. So they, you know, packaged that up. They collected all the bindings from the beds, Donna's bed sheets, which contained a pubic hair.
Okay.
That was presumed to not be hers. The holster of the gun. The sanitary napkin, a spent round that was fired into the master bedroom wall, which we think was fired to scare her.
Oh, okay.
Surely that evidence would lead to a suspect, right? Well, neighbors were questioned and surprisingly no one heard a gunshot that day, that time. And it wasn't long before police started side-eyeing the husband.
Oh, of course.
Well, it wasn't for no reason, Lena.
Uh-oh.
There were a lot of red flags.
Oh, no.
In Mr. Harvey Pounds flapping in the breeze. For starters, they couldn't find anyone to verify that he was at the department store during the time of the murder. I said it was important where he was.
Okay, right.
So he told police that he was on his lunch break. There's like this makeshift mezzanine. And it's like only big enough for one person to sit there. So he's sitting there alone having lunch.
Okay. So they're like, likely story. You're alone. Okay.
Right. So he said he, you know, had his lunch break 45 minutes, went back to work. And they said, you know, that's plenty of time to go home, kill your wife and get back to the store. Next, Harvey and Donna were actually not getting along very well.
Oh, no.
During this time. Maybe it was the impending move that was causing stress in their marriage. Maybe it was finances, or maybe it was because Harvey was becoming sweet on another lady in the congregation.
Oh, man.
And I'm not talking about Donna.
Yeah, not one of these, man.
Yeah. It wasn't exactly an affair, according to this other woman. It was like approaching an affair. But it certainly was an inappropriate relationship. Quick side note about this other woman. Just 2 years before this happened, her son murdered his babysitter because she told him to go to bed.
What?
Yeah. So when she heard that Donna Pounds was murdered.
Oh, no.
This made her feel some type of way, I'm sure.
Like so much tragedy.
Yes, exactly. And I know we say this all the time. You can't judge how a person acts if they lose their spouse because grief hits us all differently. Mm-hmm. But police couldn't help but notice that Harvey was pretty stoic. I mean, he was pretty unemotional about losing his wife. They expected at least some kind of, I don't know, just because of the shocking nature of the crime to be more bothersome to a God-fearing man. I don't know. But he acted rather detached. Maybe that's his coping style. I don't know. But he began calling the police and presenting things that he found around the house that he believed was missed evidence.
Oh, okay.
And he was kind of persistent and he kind of got on the nerves of the detectives and that made him look really suspicious. I mean, how many times do we see people inserting themselves into an investigation to see what police know, what they don't know?
Yeah.
Are you on to me?
Yeah. Like, why is he so adamant about this?
Right. Mm-hmm. The other thing was, he volunteered the information that he and his wife made love the night before. He said, you know, we made love, so you might find my...
How strange.
Isn't that weird? And you and I, and you listener, know it wasn't him.
Yeah.
But he was not doing himself any favors.
I mean, but maybe he had watched some true crime shows and he's I don't know. I know how this goes.
So, you know, back in that day, they didn't have the DNA testing.
Yeah.
But they did... blood type semen.
Okay.
So they did have, you know, they were able to say, well, it's not your blood type or it is your blood type, basically. Now, it got to the point where the lead detective went to the county attorney, Dusty DeShaw, for an arrest warrant. Because this guy, I mean, who else could it have been? They had nobody else to look at.
Wow.
He wouldn't get that arrest warrant.
Oh?
As we know, you need more than conjecture to make an arrest. And all of that suspicion was just that at the moment.
That's really interesting. Like, yeah. Some people would be like, okay, like, yeah, that's really suspicious.
And you know what? It's so subjective because we see county attorneys, state's attorneys, DAs, we see them shell out arrest warrants so much less.
Oh, yeah.
And then we see them withhold an arrest warrant when there's seemingly tons of evidence.
Yeah, that's why it surprises me here.
Yeah, it is. And it's, like I said, subjective. It's their decision.
Yeah.
So there was one more person of interest that surfaced in the days after this heinous murder, and that was Wayne Nance.
Oh, really?
So one of the Pounds' neighbors said she saw Wayne in the Pounds' backyard that afternoon, while another said she saw Wayne in the neighborhood around the time of the murder. Someone else said she saw someone who looked like Wayne walking out of the Pounds neighborhood carrying a black bag, heading towards Tamarack Trailer Park, and that's where Wayne lived.
So that's three witnesses here. So that's
three people that say they saw him or someone that looks like him. And speaking of Tamarack Trailer Park, the Pounds used to live next door to Wayne and his family. But as their family grew, they ended up moving into a house for a little bit, you know, like in a different neighborhood because the trailer was too small for them to live in. So Kenny and Wayne kind of grew up together and they weren't besties. Okay. They were convenient friends.
Okay.
You know, like the neighborhood kid that you just hang out with because you're bored and they live right next door.
Yeah. Or they're like, can you come out and play?
Yeah.
And like, I guess.
Exactly. But this new development was initially brushed off by investigators because Wayne was 18 years old and he was still in high school. I mean, he was even friends with the family and they knew that. So they were like, what's the motive? There didn't seem to be one as far as they could tell.
Yeah, but you don't just brush it off because, oh, he's 18 and he knows the family.
Yeah. They were doing great. They were doing so good.
Lord.
But one of the detectives knew Wayne to be a very strange kid. Mm-hmm. His little sister actually went to school with Wayne and was in his grade. After briefly checking to see where Wayne was and what he was doing on the day of the murder, they realized while he was supposed to be in school, he was not.
Oh.
Yeah. Now, we know he was murdering Donna Pounds, but he told police that he had stayed at home to work on a school project.
Can I see this project, please? Yeah,
exactly. Oh, I'll get to it. I'll get to it. But like Harvey's whereabouts, no one could verify Wayne's either. So maybe getting an arrest warrant for Harvey Pounds was out of the question, but maybe let's get a search warrant for Wayne's house.
Could we please?
That might be a little bit easier to pull off.
Mm-hmm.
So they did. Investigators rolled up mid-afternoon while Wayne was in school to conduct the search. Wayne's mom, Charlene, answered the door, not really surprised to see them.
Oh.
There had been rumblings that Wayne was seen in the area, and she knew they were, you know, just doing their job. She didn't think, there's no way she thought that her son did something like that, but she thought, well, they're just, they're not going to find anything.
Yeah, sure, come on in.
Yeah, so she led the detectives down the hall to Wayne's room, where she propped herself up in the doorway, watching them look around. Investigators had already tried tracking down the origin of the white clothesline rope. They went around to all the hardware stores trying to see if they could maybe match the brand or the type or see if they knew who bought the rope.
Mm-hmm.
So they were looking for that in Wayne's room. If they could find that rope, they could nail him. Maybe they could find the matching brown rubber glove in his room.
Oh, yeah. That would just be perfect.
Near the crime scene. Then they came across a black bag.
Oh.
That looked very similar to the one described by the witness who saw the Wayne lookalike or Wayne carrying it away from the Pounds' home the day of the murder.
Okay, now we feel like we're getting somewhere.
The deputy unzipped the bag and found 22 caliber shell casings inside.
Hello?
Bingo.
Mm-hmm.
They collected them. In fact, he looked at Wayne's mom and said, I'll be taking this. Meanwhile, someone else was going through Wayne's underwear drawer and found a pair of his underwear that had like a rust-colored stain on it that had clearly been washed out.
Oh.
Now, my first thought would have been skid mark, but these detectives are so much more mature than me.
Yeah.
And they thought it was blood. So they collected the undies in hopes that they could at least verify if the stain was human blood.
Okay.
By now, they thought they had gathered enough evidence. I don't know why. I don't know why they thought this was enough.
No. There's more to find.
Right, exactly. They're like, okay, let's take this to the courthouse and let's get our arrest warrant. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
What?
I mean, yes, it seems pretty damning.
Listen, the shell casings. It's the shell casings for me.
Okay, right.
It's only the shell casings for me, really. Now, Wayne had been remarking to students that he was the prime suspect in the murder for weeks now.
Oh.
Ever since he'd come on the police's radar. He sure did like talking about the fact that he was being questioned.
Bragging.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wayne told his lab partner, Stan, all about it while they were dissecting frogs in class one day.
Oh.
Stan just thought, you know, police were talking to everyone. I mean, he was friends with Kenny. It made sense that they would question him. Yeah. But he was curious as to why you would volunteer the information or bring attention to or say you're being looked at for a murder.
Yeah.
And I think it was the way Wayne was saying it. It wasn't like I'm being questioned. It was like, they're looking at me as a suspect. Like
he's boasting about it.
Yeah, exactly. Seems like something you wouldn't share.
Yeah.
But Wayne couldn't help himself. A classmate of Wayne's, a guy named Bill, had remembered an odd encounter that he had with Wayne. He was running late for afternoon class and he ran into Wayne in the hallway. It has been done. Wayne said to Bill as he breezed past, not even looking Bill's direction. Bill asked what's been done, and Wayne was acting like he was in a trance, and he repeated, "It's been done."
Okay.
Wayne showed Bill a freshly carved pentagram that he'd sliced into his arm, which was still bleeding.
Ew.
Bill and the other students had always taken Wayne's like black magic, satanic cult nonsense as just that nonsense. But now Bill was reminded that Wayne did say he wanted to kill someone before he turned 19. And having remembered the story he had just heard on the radio on his way to class, he was like, oh my gosh, he killed Donna Pounds.
Yeah, he's putting two and two, yeah.
In his head. Wayne let out this evil laugh and Bill ran.
Ew.
He ran towards his class.
Oh my Bill gosh, was I got scared. Chills.
And he knew Wayne wasn't joking. Bill had worked at Taco John's with Wayne, so he was familiar enough with Wayne's personality and like the things he would say. Mm-hmm. And he was discerning that this was wrong.
Oh, yeah.
Pretty soon, Wayne had outright even told Bill that he killed Donna Pounds.
Okay.
Now, Bill was a well-respected student. He was also very good in school. So when he took this information to the principal was like, okay, like kind of dismissive, but also I don't know you to be a liar. Mm-hmm. So if this is true, you need to call the police. He didn't want to be the one. Bill did not want to be the one to call and turn Wayne in. He was scared.
Scared of him.
He was like, if he's going to go do that to some woman, he's going to just off me in the hallway.
Yeah.
Bill's dad was the one who called the police and set up a meeting for Bill to come in and speak with detectives about what he knew. Bill went down to the station and began outlining Wayne's very strange behavior throughout his childhood and high school. And most importantly, the fact that Wayne told Bill he'd committed the murder that police were trying so desperately to solve. Donna Pounds was buried on Easter Sunday. Kenny Pounds, her son, was back in town to attend the funeral. And actually, when he came into town, what got him back in town was that somebody said his dad died.
What?
So I don't know if it was communicated that way or if he misunderstood, but his dad, Harvey Pounds, actually had a heart condition. So he assumed that when he was called back to town, that it was his dad. And it wasn't until he arrived back home that he realized his mother died and she was murdered. So
so nobody told him until he got there.
Well, you know, was it the military that told him you need to go back home? One of your parents has died, and he just assumed. Who knows? Now, sheriff's deputies also attended the funeral, standing a little further back from the ceremony to see who was there, who wasn't, etc.
Observe.
Mm-hmm. Kenny could not help, though, having this nagging feeling about that gun.
Hmm.
Like three people knew where it was. Him, his dad, his mom, and Wayne Nance.
Okay, so tell me why Wayne knew where it was.
Okay, so they maintained their friendship even after they moved. So Wayne had been to the new house many times. And he remembered one time he showed Wayne the gun. They took it out of the secret hiding spot. They even took it outside and shot it.
Oh.
And then put it back.
Okay.
So Wayne knew where it was. He was the only person that Kenny had ever shown. And the whole idea behind the hidden cabinet was that nobody was supposed to know where it was. Kenny's girlfriend was still a senior in high school, and she told Kenny all about what was being said at the school because she went to school with Wayne.
Mm-hmm.
Kenny couldn't imagine Wayne killing his mom. I mean, he was like, there was no motive.
Right.
He did entertain the idea and he scrutinized his interactions with Wayne. Like, is he going to be weird around me? Is he going to be able to look me in the eye? But there was nothing about Wayne's behavior that really caused him any alarm.
Wow.
I know. The police came up empty as well. Remember the pieces of evidence that were collected at the crime scene? They had the pubic hair on the bed and from Wayne's room, the soiled underwear from his drawer. That seems to be pretty promising evidence, right?
Right.
Well, the pubic hair blew away.
Oh no.
I mean, I don't know if it actually blew away, but
it was
they
missing.
Lost it.
It was
so
gone.
I imagine whew, it blew away. While the FBI was able to verify that Wayne's undies did have human blood on them, it was too washed for them to do any sort of blood typing.
Mm.
Yeah. And they had probably been laundered a couple times by that point.
Like, sir, was your bottom bleeding?
Yeah.
What's going on
Explain.
Here?
Explain. They had nothing on Wayne. Mm. This is what the book says.
Okay.
He even passed a polygraph.
Of course he did.
Yeah.
He's a professional.
The shell casings, though, I dug and dug and dug. And the shell casings are just, it's like they're not mentioned ever again. And I'm like,
yeah, I need to know like what he said, why he had these.
I don't understand. Like, could they not do ballistic testing
right.
and match it back in the
70s? Of course
I don't
they
know.
Could.
It bothers me. But he passed a polygraph and they certainly didn't have anything on Harvey Pounds.
Mm-hmm.
So Donna Pounds' murder case went cold.
Oh my gosh.
Now,
could you imagine neighbors like how afraid they were?
Oh, yeah. A grand jury was actually convened 2 years later in 1976 to present evidence to a jury to secure an indictment in the Donna Pounds murder because years had gone by, nothing had surfaced, and the county attorney wasn't willing to indict Wayne or Harvey, so maybe a grand jury would if they heard all of the evidence.
Oh, right.
Now, Wayne was asked, you know, he had to testify before the grand jury. Wayne was asked all the same questions he'd been asked before about Donna Pound's murder. Character witnesses testified to Wayne's oddities. A teacher testified about how that school project, quote unquote, that Wayne stayed home from school for to work on that day of Donna Pound's murder. Well, this teacher who taught an ancient weapons class.
Oh.
That wasn't an elective at Bethesda Christian School. This teacher said that the school project was to make a tomahawk.
What?
So Wayne was saying, yeah, I was looking for sticks and stones to break my bones. And this teacher said, yeah, that was the school project, but it was the semester before.
Okay. So we have a problem here.
So he's like, I don't know why Wayne was walking around in people's backyards looking for sticks and stones.
I mean,
just don't
the
know.
The 70s was just built different.
I know.
Let's build a tomahawk for school.
Ancient weapons class in high school?
No.
What is the school? So Wayne was on the stand for a couple days for a collective like 7 hours.
Oh, wow.
But Harvey? Harvey was on the stand even longer.
Really?
Yes.
I mean, he really had to prove that he had nothing to do with this.
Man. Harvey. This poor guy, but also like stop being.
Yeah. Like if you just.
Such a douche.
If you were righteous in the first place.
I know. Exactly. He was doing it all wrong. The grand jury was looking at both men.
Mm.
The grand jury found no cause to indict either Wayne or Harvey for the murder of Donna Pounds. And like I said, the shell casings, were they test? Like,
yeah,
they mustn't have been because that would have been a smoking gun. That would have been some pretty sufficient physical evidence.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, it seems like that's really all they need is just to test this ballistics.
Yeah. And you know what? Like you said, the community was probably so scared. After this grand jury convened, you would have thought they'd have been outraged. Like, what do you mean neither of them did it? But actually, they felt kind of like the grand jury conducted a thorough investigation and they were like, okay, you know, it wasn't either of them.
Well,
so,
see, my first thought when you said they couldn't come up with, yes, they did this, my first thought was, I mean, they took their job seriously because they didn't want to convict or charge someone for murder if they didn't do it.
And that's the reason we get all the time when they don't, you know, they say we can't because of double jeopardy. Yeah. You don't want to take someone to trial. Well, we don't have enough evidence because you want to have that evidence before you arrest somebody. Yeah. You don't just want to be like, let's arrest him and then we'll investigate the crime. Right. I mean, you have to have probable cause. You have to have a list. So we often see when they won't issue an arrest warrant, it's because they don't want to risk it.
Yeah. Risk it for the biscuit.
Risk it for the biscuit. Oh, biscuit sounds really good right now. So things kind of went back to normal in Missoula. Shortly after the whole grand jury thing, when Wayne returned to his post in the military, he got in trouble with the Navy for being in possession of marijuana. Mm. So he got in trouble. They're like, okay, that don't do it again. Mm-hmm. Which I was surprised. I mean, I feel like these days they'd have been like, bye.
Yeah.
But he got in trouble for it like twice before they ended up discharging him with a general discharge.
Oh.
Now, murderers always, I feel like, join the military. They always get out of town, you know, on the government's dime. But it never works out for them because mm-hmm. they have rigid personality types mm-hmm. and they won't be told what to do, right? Wayne came crawling back to his parents' house and his dad told everyone that he was honorably discharged.
Oh, what an honorable man.
Yeah, he was like, you know, the Navy, they have unbearable procedures. In 1980, Wayne's mother, Charlene, died in a car accident that was ruled a suicide. George had gone up to the cabin, which was a local dive, and confronted Charlene about working there. You see, she was working at the truck stop across the street, and she just somehow like migrated over and started working at the cabin, I guess to supplement income. She didn't quit her job at the truck stop, but he didn't want her working there. Oh. He didn't think that was a place for a wife and mother to be working. She was able to drink on the job. She flirted with patrons.
Oh, man.
And so George didn't like it. So George, he drove up to the cabin and went inside and started a fight with
her. Oh, no.
So they start arguing and it spills out into the parking lot. Well, Charlene got in her car and she drove away. And he started to follow her, but she was going the opposite direction of their house. So he's like, you know what? I'm just going to go home. He thought she would eventually just come home. But shortly after, two police officers arrived at his home to tell him that Charlene was dead. I mean, what a shocker that must have been.
Oh, yeah.
Can you imagine being George and being like, you know, she'll be home any second. We'll finish this fight. Like,
yeah, but I mean, at the same time, like if she can drink on the job, like,
right.
She left the place possibly under the influence.
That was one of the, and it's not really said, she probably had been drinking, but they said that she ran her car into a tree and it actually split her car in half.
Oh my.
But the accident reconstructionist ruled it a suicide because they said she shouldn't have turned into the tree.
Oh.
Like it's not something she would have accidentally run into, if that makes sense. I almost abbreviated the death of his mom because like you may not think it's relevant, but I think in a lot of ways, like when George went to jail, Wayne's mom's death kind of provided him a little leeway in the community, you know, like a buffer between the suspicion that they had previously and all his weirdness and Wayne's future. Maybe we were wrong about him, the poor guy.
Oh.
And that's where I'm going to have to leave you for part one.
Oh, that's a big cliffhanger.
Yeah, I'm sorry. There's no way to really end it.
Well, that was great. Let's hurry up and get to it.
Yeah, let's do it again.
Bye, guys. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Cousins on Crime. Get connected with us by becoming a free member on our Patreon. Or for just $5 a month, you'll have access to bonus episodes, discussion groups, and much more. If you can't afford $5 a month, we get it. Inflation, am I right? Please consider leaving us a positive review and rating wherever you listen.
And don't forget merch. Support our podcast and show the love by sporting t-shirts with our latest designs, or grab an evidence bag to keep the chain of custody for all your valuables. Don't forget to follow our show on your favorite streaming app so you never miss an episode, and get photos and updates on our Instagram at Cousins on Crime Podcast or our Cousins on Crime Facebook page. Have a case suggestion? Email us at cousinsoncrime@gmail.com.